Thanks very much, Chris, for that introduction, and for Bradley and Cedar for hosting this event, and People's Choice and Adelaide Uni for sponsoring it. Of course, while it may be the most important economic event, it's not the most important event happening in Adelaide today, because that would be what's happening this evening down the road at the Adelaide Oval. Although I'd have to admit, I'm a Carlton fan because I left Adelaide just before the Crows ever started. So, but at least the rest of you get to support a team which is at the top of the ladder rather than at the bottom of the ladder like I have to put up with. But as I said, we're not here to talk football, though I'm happy to talk about that. We're here to talk about economics today. And so what I would like to do is talk about some of the factors that the Reserve Bank takes into consideration in making its interest rate decision each month. And while they're both domestic and global, today what I'd like to do is talk about some of the global influences on domestic monetary policy. Now, there we go. So as you are well aware, the Australian economy doesn't operate in isolation from the rest of the world, and that is clearly also true when it comes to monetary policy. So while the goals of monetary policy are very much domestic in terms of inflation and employment, the influences on the achievement of these goals are both domestic and global. So in talking about the global influences on the setting of monetary policy, I will make the probably obvious point, I hope it's obvious, that the policy rate here in Australia is at an historic low, in no small part because policy rates elsewhere in the world are also around historic lows. And so one of the things I want to talk about today is that why are global policy rates as low as they are? And part of the explanation is that to meet their policy goals, central banks in other advanced economies outside Australia have had expansionary settings since the start of the global financial crisis in 2007. Moreover, in the biggest advanced economies, so the US, UK and the euro area, policymakers have provided further monetary policy stimulus through large asset purchase programs, that is mostly buying up government debt, which has seen central bank balance sheets increase significantly in size. But another part of the explanation is that the neutral level of the policy rate has declined in most countries, including here in Australia. And that was what attracted a fair bit of the attention that Chris was referring to earlier. That is, the level of the policy rate where monetary policy is neither providing stimulus nor restraint is much lower than it used to be. So central banks have had to set their policy rates even lower than that already lower neutral policy rate to provide the appropriate stimulus to their economies. So let me just give you a bit of a look at where what I'm going to talk about. So I'll start by talking about four common global factors that have led to the expansionary monetary policy settings seen in most advanced economies for almost a decade, and use that to talk about why policy rates are so low. These four factors are present in Australia to varying degrees. I will then talk about the neutral policy rate and the fact that it's declined over the past decade. And then I'll finish with some comments on the influence of global financial factors on domestic monetary policy considerations here in Australia. So let me talk first about what those four global economic factors. So here they are. The subdued global recovery post-crisis, which is now 10 years old. The low level of investment around the world. Subdued wages growth despite low unemployment rates, and then how all of that feeds into the low inflation that we see today. So the first and most obvious factor influencing monetary policy settings globally is the financial crisis and its aftermath. So the large and rapid decline in policy set rate settings in most advanced economies occurred in 2007 and 2008. So in most other parts of the world, interest rates were reduced markedly almost 10 years ago now. So over this period, many policy rates were reduced to close to zero, and subsequently, in a number of cases, even below zero. So the collapse in global output and trade at the end of 2008 was sharp and significant. And the severity of the episode was increased by the fact that it was synchronised across the global economy, all at the same time. The last quarter of 2008, you saw basically every economy in the world contract, and in some cases by a very large amount. But it's now 10 years since the onset of the crisis, and nearly 9 years since that, sort of when it was at its worst in the last quarter of 2008, yet we still see policy rates at their post-crisis lows. The Fed in the US has raised its policy rate in recent times, that's true, but even then, only four times in quarter point increments, quarter percentage point increments, so that the policy rate in the US has only now just reached 1%. That said, in the US, broader measures of financial conditions suggest that their policy or financial conditions aren't tighter since the Fed started increasing its policy rate 2 years ago. That is, they've raised their policy rate, but financial conditions haven't even tightened. Long-term bond yields in the US and the US dollar exchange rate are both no higher than when the Fed first increased its policy rate. Corporate bond yields there remain near historic lows, and US equity prices are considerably higher. So the effects of the financial crisis on most parts of the advanced world have been very long-lasting. Global economic growth has mostly fallen a little short of expectations for all of the past decade. As a result, even with those expansionary monetary policy settings that we see, aggregate global growth has been only average over this time, but not better than average, which would have been what we were after given how large the loss of output was back in 2008 and 2009. So as I'm sure you know, Australia didn't suffer from the same decline in output that many other advanced economies underwent, and this slide gives you some comparisons as to how different economies have gone since 2007. In fact, the number on the US isn't quite right on the slide, but it's right in my text. In the level of GDP in Australia, it's 27% higher than it was in 2007. In the US, actually, it's not 37, it's only 13% higher. And in the UK, it's 10%. And in the euro area, they only just got back to where they were in 2007 a couple of years ago. So we've had an okay amount of growth over the past decade, but in those other countries, if you look at what's happened over the past 10 years, growth has been very subpar, particularly given how large that contraction in output was. And it's only quite recently that forecasts for the global economy have been revised higher for the first time in many years. So we've had nearly a decade where forecasters have put out an expectation that the global economy is going to pick up, and then it doesn't. But for the first time in a long time, and so they have to revise their forecasts lower, but now, over the last 6-9 months, you've actually had people revising their forecasts up, not down. And this has reflected an upswing in industrial production and exports across a large chunk of the global economy. And a critical question right now is whether this upswing is going to be sustained. So one of the reasons, if I go back to these four factors, one of the reasons that global growth after the financial crisis has been only moderate is the second of these factors here that I'd like to talk about, which is the low level of business investment over the past decade. So many of the preconditions that historically led to a pickup in business investment have been in place. We've had low policy interest rates, there's been low borrowing costs for most businesses, there have been strong corporate debt markets, but we haven't had any material growth in investment. So something has clearly been missing that has prevented those positive preconditions from generating an upswing in business investment. So one obvious candidate is uncertainty about future demand, uncertainty about how the global economy is going to go in the future, or as it is often referred to, animal spirits. So to some extent, this lack of animal spirits has been self-fulfilling. If businesses are not confident about whether there will be enough demand in the future to justify more investment, they hold off spending on investment, and then lo and behold, output isn't as strong as they thought it was. As the global economy has become more integrated, there seems to be a more important common global element in animal spirits. And one driver of this may well be that we have a lot of multinational firms making investment decisions across a number of economies all at the same time. In Australia, the investment dynamics have been clearly different. In marked contrast to the rest of the world, business investment in Australia over the past decade has been at historic highs rather than historic lows, largely as a result of investment in the resource sector. But now, resource investment has fallen most of the way back to its pre-boom levels. So we've now nearly unwound all of that large increase in resource investment that we've experienced over the past 10 years. And investment outside the resources sector in Australia has remained at a low level as it has in other countries. So the reasons why investment's been low elsewhere in the world seem to very much apply to why investment outside the resources sector here in Australia has also been low. That said, it has actually grown modestly here over the last couple of years. In recent months, there have been some positive signs on investment spending in a number of countries around the world. If this is sustained, then it's possible that the animal spirits switch from being self-fulfillingly negative to self-fulfillingly positive. As we see signs of investment picking up this year in some other countries, there is an increased chance that this may be reflected in Australia too. And a gradual pickup in investment is something that's embodied in our current growth forecasts. The third factor I'd like to talk about is low wages growth. So here's a picture of wages growth in the US, the UK, Japan and Australia over the past 20 years or so. And you can see, most obviously, in Japan it's just been low forever, but outside of Japan you can see in the US, the UK and here there's been a marked step down in wages growth. And this is occurring despite very low unemployment rates in countries such as the US, Germany, Japan and the UK. The unemployment rates in those countries are at levels that have historically been associated with an acceleration in wages growth, but we're not seeing it here. We're not seeing it yet. And the governor talked about this in a speech late last year. My counterpart, Andy Haldane, at the Bank of England recently discussed some of the possible explanations for this stubbornly low wages growth and concluded that in the end, we don't yet have a particularly good explanation for it. That said, one of the things I learnt when I was studying economics here, possibly from Chris, was we do know that the labour supply curve ultimately does slope upwards. So that what I mean by that is that if unemployment rate continues to decline in these countries, we have to be getting closer to the point where wage pressures do start to materialise, but we aren't seeing it yet. And wages growth in Australia, as this graph makes clear, is subdued as it is elsewhere in the world. One difference in Australia, though, which is worth noting, is that productivity growth here has generally been higher than it has been in these other countries in recent years. So as a result, in Australia, there has been no growth in unit labour costs, that's wages adjusted for productivity, for the past 5 years. So where the level of unit labour costs today in Australia is exactly the same as it was 5 years ago. That's not true elsewhere in the world, where unit labour cost growth has been quite a bit higher because those other countries haven't actually experienced very good productivity growth at all. The fourth and last common factor I want to talk about is the sustained low inflation that has been evident globally for the past decade. So as you can see, it's not quite so obvious here. You can certainly, if I took it back to through the 90s and the 80s, the current period looks particularly low. But you can see in the US, inflation's been spent much more time below 2% than it has above 2% for all of the past decade. The same's true in Germany. In Japan, it's been stubbornly stuck at zero, despite the efforts of the Bank of Japan. And here, inflation's been very much at the low end of recent experience for a while now. Now, this low inflation is a direct consequence of the three previous factors I've just talked about. But in addition to those influences, there's been a continuation of the disinflationary pressure resulting from the integration of China into the global economy. There are some signs that that force, at least, is starting to wane, with producer prices in China actually growing following many years of continual and often quite substantial declines. In fact, one of the things I did when I was a research assistant for Chris back in my days here was actually trying to find statistics on prices in China, I recall. But these days, we do have those numbers and they do show these quite substantial declines in China, but they actually have started to turn around over the past few years, which is different than what's been going on for most of the past decade. Throughout the past decade, though, globally, expectations about future inflation have remained broadly anchored, which at times has helped to stave off a shift towards deflation. So while inflation is low here, with the exception of Japan, we haven't actually seen deflation in any of the major economies. So these four factors, the subdued global recovery, low investment, subdued wages growth, despite low unemployment rates and low inflation, are the primary explanation for the very stimulatory policy settings we see globally. So what I've got here are the monetary policy interest rates in Australia, the euro area, the US, and Japan. So Japan, most of the time, is actually at zero or just below, which is a bit hard to see there. And in the US, for most of the past decade, up until quite recently, it was at zero. And in the euro area, it's actually below zero, which wasn't something you probably learnt when you're in your undergraduate days, that interest rates could actually be below zero, let alone policy interest rates. But lo and behold, we've had negative interest rates in Europe for a few years now. We've had them in Japan, and we've got them in other parts of the world as well. So the fact that they are at such low levels in those major advanced economies has a material influence on why the policy interest rate in Australia is also at an historic low. Beyond these factors that I've just discussed, another significant factor contributing to the low level of policy rates globally is that the neutral policy rate in many countries have declined over the past decade. So let me talk a bit about that. The neutral interest rate provides a benchmark for assessing the current stance of monetary policy. If the real policy rate, that is the cash rate, what I've got here, less inflation expectations, is below the neutral rate, then monetary policy is exerting an expansionary influence on the economy. If the real policy rate is above the neutral rate, then policy is exerting a contractionary influence on the economy. So the neutral rate is often associated with the turn of the 20th century Swedish economist Wicksell and was picked up by Keynes. The previous governor, Glenn Stevens, discussed the neutral rate in the Australian context a bit more than a decade ago. And as you may have read in the paper, there was a discussion of the neutral rate at the most recent board meeting, as detailed in the minutes that we put out earlier this week. Now, despite all the kerfuffle around that, there was no significance should be read into the fact the neutral rate was discussed at this particular meeting. Most meetings, the board spends some time discussing a policy-relevant issue in more detail. This time around, it just happened to be the neutral rate. We work out what are those topics going to be sort of 6-9 months in advance, so there really was nothing special about why it was this month and not some other month. Anyway, that said, let me go on to talk a bit more about it. The neutral rate aligns the amount of saving and investment at a level that is consistent with the goals of monetary policy, that is, full employment and stable inflation. So it's where the policy rate would settle down in the medium term when everything in the economy is going along how we would like it to go. So accordingly, most explanations of the neutral rate start with factors that influence savings and investment. Developments that increase savings tend to lower the neutral rate. Things that increase investment will tend to raise it. So there are three main factors that affect the neutral rate in Australia. One is the economy's potential growth rate. That's how fast the economy can grow without generating inflation pressure. The degree of risk aversion in the economy, and then thirdly, global factors. So one of the main determinants is the economy's potential growth rate. If we have a high potential growth rate because we have strong productivity growth or population growth, then that generates more demand, generates more investment, and prospect of high income reduces the incentives of households to save. That tends to push the neutral rate up. So if the economy's got a higher potential growth rate, higher neutral rate. The potential growth rate in the economy tends to evolve quite slowly, so we don't expect that to move the interest rate around all that much from quarter to quarter. But another influence on the neutral rate is the risk appetite of firms and households and the way risk has been priced into market interest rates, and that can move rapidly. When risk aversion rises, firms require more compensation to make longer-term investments with an uncertain return. Households are going to be more likely to save more. And those two factors both lower the neutral rate any given level of policy rate is less expansionary because of the increased risk aversion. If there is an increase in risk aversion, it is also likely that there will be a widening in the spreads between the policy rate and market rates. So a widening in the spread between the cash rate here and, say, the mortgage rate in the economy or the rate that businesses borrow at. So a given market interest rate will correspond to a lower policy rate if spreads widen, and that will further lower the neutral rate. And then finally, in an open economy like Australia, where capital can move freely across borders, global rates will also influence domestic interest rates. So that means movements in the neutral rate in other countries are going to also affect the neutral rate here in Australia. So how do we actually calculate this thing? Because it's not actually directly observable. So there are a number of different ways of doing it, from the behaviour of market rates and other economic variables. And so here's some estimates that we've come up with for the neutral rate. So the red line in the middle is the average, but then the shaded areas give you the sort of range that this thing can the estimates can move in, let alone knowing whether that's actually what it is. So there's a fair amount of uncertainty about this thing. It's not that precise. But what all of the estimates show is that the neutral rate now is a fair bit lower than it was in 2007. How much lower depends on which estimate you want to use, but whichever way you want to estimate it, it's a lot lower now than where it was in 2007. So on this as well, I've got the cash rate adjusted for inflation, so the real cash rate. So when that black line is above the red line, policy is contractionary. When it's below the red line, policy is expansionary. And if you look through that, it pretty much lines up with what most people would have thought at the time. So it's what that shows is that in the early 2000s, in 2008, and for the past 5 years or so, monetary policy has been expansionary. The estimates of the neutral rate, if you look there, also suggest that from around about the mid-90s through into 2007, it was actually pretty stable. And in Glenn Stevens' speech that I mentioned earlier, he noted that the cash rate at the time he gave the speech, which was 2004, was probably somewhere around 2.5% to 3.5%, which luckily, it's not always the case that when you say something and you go back and estimate it 15 years later, it actually turns out to be about right. But in this case, it actually is consistent with the estimates shown here. So the graph, as I said, shows a clear step down in all the estimates of the policy of the neutral rate in 2007-08, and that has probably drifted lower since. It suggests that the rate, neutral rate today is currently around 150 basis points. That's 1.5 percentage points lower than it was in 2007. And that can largely be accounted for by a slowdown in productivity growth and an increase in risk aversion. So our best guess of best estimate of potential growth rate for Australia has declined by around about 0.5 percentage point from the mid-90s. So potential growth in Australia now may be around about 0.5 percentage point lower than it was in the mid-90s, which mostly reflects lower labour force growth. The slowdown in potential growth has probably translated about one for one into a decline in the neutral rate, though the decline has been gradual. The sharper decline that you can see in 2007-08 can most easily be related to the sharp increase in risk aversion with the onset of the financial crisis. And this increased risk aversion probably accounts for most of the large fall in estimated neutral rates in Australia and in other countries that occurred at the time. And that's also increased, been reflected in an increase in spreads between the cash rate, the policy rate, and borrowing rates like the housing mortgage rate and business borrowing rates. Although these effects are hard to quantify, the fact that those spreads are going up has almost certainly increased, lowered the neutral rate. If I should do it in a global context, what I've done here is shown some estimates. The estimates for Australia are our estimates, and those for Canada and the UK and the US and Europe, which are roughly the same in each case, are estimates from other institutions. So you can see there that on average, neutral interest rate estimates for Australia are similar to those in the UK and Canada, but higher than those for the US and the euro area. As is the case for Australia, the estimates were fairly stable until around about the mid-2000s and have fallen since then. And the decline in all cases was particularly sharp in 2007-08, and again, most likely reflects the increase in risk aversion at the start of the financial crisis. And because the determinants of neutral rates tend to be highly correlated across the advanced economies, it's actually hard to distinguish between international influences and domestic influences on it, but it's highly likely that the decline in neutral rates in other countries has contributed to a decline in Australia's neutral policy rate. So in short, the policy rate in Australia is low because the neutral rate is lower than it used to be as a result of both international and domestic developments. That means that the current setting of the cash rate, which is 1.5% today, is not as expansionary as a cash rate of 1.5% would have been in the 1990s or in the first half of the 2000s. So another way of putting that is, so you know, a cash rate of 1.5% sounds very low, but if I go back to the previous slide, you can see that the gap between the black line and the red line has been larger in the past than it is now. So the policy settings are stimulatory now with a cash rate of 1.5%, but not necessarily, you know, they're no more or less symmetry than they have been in times in the past. Looking ahead, the neutral rate both here in Australia and as well as in other advanced economies is likely to remain lower than it was in the past. It is because mostly because potential growth rates look like they're going to be lower for a while. It is plausible that the degree of risk aversion, which caused that spike lower in 2007, might reverse in time, which would receive the neutral rate rise from its current low level. But other developments are going to, may be more permanent. In addition to the neutral rate declining, policy rates in other countries have been set even lower than that low neutral rate to provide the appropriate stimulus. On top of that, in a number of the major economies, policy is more expansionary than indicated by just the level of policy interest rate. So what I've got here is the size of central banks' balance sheets relative to the size of their economy. So you see the Bank of Japan's balance sheet is almost the same size as the whole of the Bank of Japan, of the Japanese economy. And you can see the rise in the size of the balance sheet in the euro area and in the US. But you can see that here our balance sheet has remained roughly the same size as it has been for a long time. There's a little bit of a rise in 2008, but that was subsequently reversed fairly quickly. Why have these balance sheets gone up? That's because those central banks have been purchasing assets mainly in the form of government debt, with the Bank of Japan being the biggest purchaser of government debt. So the fact that monetary policy settings are more expansionary in the rest of the world than in Australia, both through lower policy rates and balance sheet expansion, has been putting upward pressure on the Australian dollar. Capital is attracted here by the higher rates of return on offer, and that's likely to cause the exchange rate to appreciate. So while an easier monetary policy elsewhere in the world, so when these guys ease monetary policy, that makes their economies grow faster, hopefully, that's good for the Australian economy, and appreciating Australian dollar works against that. So to put it in economic terms, there are offsetting income and substitution effects for the Australian economy. Whether in net terms it's positive or negative for Australia is an empirical issue. And generally the evidence suggests that widening interest differentials do lead to an appreciation of the Australian dollar. So that does counteract the benefit to the Australian economy of faster global growth. It's conceivable that unconventional monetary policy, which is what this is often described as, may have a larger financial impact than movements in interest rates. That is, the effects of balance sheets expansions on the exchange rate may be larger, while the effects in terms of higher output, in terms of stimulating growth in these economies, may be smaller. Again, it's an empirical issue. Moreover, central bank asset purchases generate cross-border capital flows from investors seeking higher returns. Some of that we do see in a higher currency, but some of those cross-border flows are not quite so obvious. Investors often tend to hedge their exchange rate exposures to protect from exchange rate movements. So as these investments increase, there is more demand for such hedges, which causes the cost of that hedging to rise. And a direct measure of this is something called the cross-currency basis. So the most obvious example is out of Japan. There's a very wide yen basis, mostly because there's a lot of money coming out of Japan. Some of it comes directly and buys Australian assets, pushes up the Australian dollar. But some of it, a large chunk of it, is actually hedged so that they protect themselves from the exchange rate. And you see that in a very wide yen basis. It's actually, to some extent, a good thing that those investments are hedged, because if they weren't, we'd see even more of the effect of those capital flows in the exchange rate. From the Japanese investors in particular placing their funds in Australia, and the Australian dollar would have appreciated by more. So that hedging has served as something of a shock absorber for those cross-border flows. But that aside, those expansionary settings of monetary policy globally clearly have had a material influence on domestic monetary policy settings through the impact of capital flows on the exchange rate. And a French economist, Helene Ray, has recently described this state of affairs as a monetary dilemma. So independent monetary policies, she says, are possible if and only if the capital account is managed. That is, we can only run an independent monetary policy in Australia if we have some control on the capital flow coming into the country. I don't think the situation is quite as stark as Helene says. There is still a substantial degree of flexibility to set domestic monetary policy appropriate for domestic conditions. But I would certainly agree that the monetary policy decisions of other central banks are a significant factor to take into account in our monetary policy deliberations here. So another way of putting it is that we don't have the independence to set the neutral rate, which is significantly influenced by global forces, but we do have the independence to set where we set our policy rate relative to the neutral rate. So let me finish up and to conclude. I've outlined today a number of the channel of influences that global developments have on domestic monetary policy settings. Some of these forces are transmitted through the real economy in terms of things like investment and wages, but some through financial channels. The effects of these global influences on the Australian economy have been material. The global economic environment and global policy settings that have been in place for the past decade have contributed significantly to the monetary policy settings in Australia that we have today and will continue to do so for the foreseeable future. Now, currently, financial markets don't expect any further lowering of policy rates in the major economies, nor any further expansion in policy settings. Hence, the downward pressure on our domestic policy settings here from this source doesn't look like it's going to get any worse in the foreseeable future. But the four common factors, low investment, low inflation, wages, and the recovery from the crisis that I highlighted in the first half of my speech, they're still present. There are some tentative signs that they are abating, but the evidence is inconclusive as of today. As I said earlier, the Fed has raised its policy rate very gradually over the past couple of years, and last week the Bank of Canada increased its policy rate to 0.75%, 0.75%. So just as the policy rate in Australia didn't need to go down to the very low levels seen in other parts of the world, the fact that other central banks increase their policy rates doesn't automatically mean that the policy rate here needs to increase too. The policy rates in both the US and Canada still remain below that in Australia. Ultimately, in Australia, as is the case elsewhere, policy rates are set at the level assessed to be appropriate to achieve the domestic policy objectives. So while global influences, including monetary policy settings in other economies, have a significant impact on that assessment, they are, in the end, only one of a number of considerations to be taken into account. So let me finish there and not stand in the way of lunch, but hope that gives you some idea of some of the global considerations that we have to take account of in setting the domestic monetary policy decision. So I'll stop there, let everyone have some lunch, and then I think, Chris, we're coming back for some questions after you've got some food in your stomach. Thanks.
Let's begin the discussion part of today's event. So let me check a couple of things with Guy first, and then I'll open it up to the floor. I'll just make sure I can see everybody. And when you ask a question, then I'll ask you to identify yourself and say where you're from. So, Guy, I think what the release of the minutes set off was some arithmetic, which said that here's something called the neutral rate, and the current cash rate's less than that. So the inference was drawn that the lower is going to go to the higher. You're saying to us, I think, today, just be a bit careful about that drawing that inference.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I suppose what I was saying is that the fact that we were talking about there was discussion of the neutral rate at the board meeting didn't have any implications for near-term monetary policy decisions. It's just one of the things that you need to have in the back of your mind when you're thinking about the policy setting. Amongst other things, having some assessment of where neutral is gives you some idea about how expansionary, or contractionary for that matter, but today, expansionary, this current stance of policy is. Mm. So without that point of reference, it's a little hard to work out, how expansionary the current settings of policy are.
So as you said, if the current rate looks low, but if the neutral rate's falling, then
is it not as low as it not, looks not, on the face of it?
It's not as low as it looks on the face of it. Let me ask you one other thing, which was about markets for assets like houses. So that's been one of the mechanics at work here, has it not, during this period since the financial crisis, with low interest rates, the availability of funds for investment, low investment in regular production processes, people been buying up other assets? Can you talk us through what's the story there? How does that play into thinking about what the options are?
Part of the transmission of expansionary monetary policy, both interest rates and probably more so in terms of the asset purchases, is by pushing. It does have an influence in terms of pushing up asset prices, and the idea then still is to encourage corporate investment and the like. But you see equity prices are higher. That's one of the transmission channels. Some cases, house prices are higher. I mean, one thing which is interesting in Australia is that in some places, house prices are higher, like the place I live currently. The place I used to live here, house prices aren't quite so high, but everyone's borrowing pretty much at the same rate. So we have, we don't, in Australia's a pretty good example, there's not a universal effect on house prices. We have some markets where house prices are rising rapidly, but some where they aren't. But in Perth, they're falling. But everyone's still looking at the same interest rate. So, you know, interest rates are one of the influences, but there's clearly a few other ones going on too.
Mm, okay. So there's not a one-way process. If you start raising the cash rate, that there'll be necessarily some fallout in those asset markets.
Well, there's probably going to be an impact on it, but just as there's an impact from lowering rates, there's also an impact of rising rates. But as in economics, most things in economics, it depends what other stuff is going on at the same time. Mm.
And last one from me was about productivity. I mean, the concept of the neutral rate is a very neutral concept, it seems to me. It's built on the notion of this potential growth rate of output, but you know, in the context that we're moving into with an ageing society, demands to finance and provide services for those people, I think we'd kind of like a higher potential rate of growth. So that's another big story here, how to increase the potential rate of growth. Is that right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And one of the best ways of doing it is this, is education, particularly University of Adelaide education, obviously. But I think a lot of people here would agree with that, particularly Mike. But in all seriousness, education is actually a big part of the story, both secondary and primary, secondary and tertiary, all of those. That's got a lot to do, human capital is a major driver of productivity growth. You know, if you think about it in the end, mostly it boils down to human capital and technology. Well, technology normally needs human capital to create it as well. So, as you say, if we've got I mentioned earlier, we've had a slowdown in potential growth mostly because of demographic factors. Mm. Those aren't going to reverse anytime soon, both here and even more so in some of the other advanced economies, and actually most notably in China. But something which can go in the opposite direction very much is productivity, and a fair chunk of the driver of that is going to come from education.
Good, thank you. So let me turn to the audience and ask who'd like to ask a question or make a comment. And as I said, would you, there's a microphone coming. You, would you tell us your name and where you're from?
Thank you, Guy. Joe Thorpe, Tech & SA. One of the other issues, of course, is exchange rates and our capacity to buy cheap televisions and have wonderful cheap holidays in North America, juxtaposed against this agrarian and mining economy and export economy. So your former chief executive, Governor of the Reserve Bank, spent quite a lot of time in a public campaign trying to talk down the exchange rate, and here it is stubbornly high. What's your comment on exchange rate and how that interplays against the other issues you talked about today?
Yeah, well, the exchange rate clearly has is one of the forces which has a fairly significant influence on what's going on in the domestic economy, both in terms of output and inflation. And as we've said on a number of occasions, appreciating exchange rate in the current conjuncture isn't helpful. So, you know, that lower exchange rate is probably going to be more helpful in terms of the sort of forces we're looking at the moment. So, the exchange rate certainly matters. Given the adjustment we've been going through over the last few years in terms of the coming off that resource investment boom, we've said repeatedly in our press statements, including last month, that an appreciating exchange rate would complicate that adjustment. So if the exchange rate's appreciating it, it's complicating that adjustment.
Thanks. Con Michalakis, Statewide Super. Is the 3.5 neutral rate a bit like Carlton? It's a long way to a premiership. So do you see the rate adjustment taking a long time to get into play?
I don't know which one's going to come first, Con. Carlton's showing about as many promising sides as the Australian economy, which is a good thing, not a bad. as I said, in response to Chris's question, it's to use another football analogy, it's sort of useful to know where the goalposts are in working out how far away you are from them. It was a discussion which we. For a while, we have discussions at the board, most of the time actually, we have discussions at the boards on particular sort of more medium and long-term issues, just to make sure the policy discussion is fully informed, and this time around it was the neutral rate. As I showed in the estimates earlier, there's a fair amount of uncertainty about where it actually is. I think we're fairly confident we're below it at the moment. In fact, we're very confident we're below it at the moment. How far below it, where exactly it is, not quite so confident. But as I said, it wasn't something which was a near-term policy consideration. It was more just as much to be able to assess, get some assessment about what the current, what provide some context about what the current stance of monetary policy is. I think it's useful for people to have in their back of the minds, both in terms of the monetary, in terms of the Reserve Bank Board, but for people in the economy at large, as to where, in the fullness of time, rates might settle, which is probably higher than where they are today, but certainly wasn't anything in terms of implications for the near for the near term.
Hi, Guy. Jane Durham from Funds SA. Thanks for your presentation. I wanted to ask you a question about inflation targeting, and the Reserve Bank has that as a target, and whether other targets are being considered. And I guess I raise that in the light of Warwick McGibbon's comments during the week.
We think that inflation targeting has done and continues to do the sort of job. It's a useful framework for monetary policy. Do we think about other frameworks? Yeah. I think what Warwick's talking about in terms of nominal income targeting isn't miles away from what we actually do. I think he even acknowledged, he would, in fact, I don't think I know that he would acknowledge that himself. I think there are a couple of things you need to think about in terms of frameworks for monetary policy. One is the ability to communicate and what influence that has. So if I compare inflation targeting with nominal income targeting, I think most people have some understanding about what inflation is, prices going up and down. People have a little bit more trouble getting their heads around nominal income. So, and what that is, and also where it's going. But as I said, I don't think the two things are miles apart, but we've been comfortable in terms of the outcomes, you know, which we've seen with the Australian economy using the framework that we've had for nigh on, what are we talking now, nearly 25 years. Seems to have gone okay. Doesn't mean you don't need to continually review whether it's appropriate, but we don't see any particular reason to change it at the moment.
Who'd like to go next? Jane? That's coming. That's coming. Yeah.
So do I, but they can insist on what I can be too.
Hi, I'm Jane Ewell from ANZ. There's an awful lot of liquidity in the market globally, which has been sensational for businesses in the last few years. Do you see that continuing?
I always struggle to work out what people are talking about in terms of liquidity, because sometimes there's market liquidity and then there's liquidity in terms of central bank balance sheets. And that's all right, I'm going to get to your question. So one thing which I mentioned earlier is that if you look at the size of central bank balance sheets, they've grown a lot relative to the size of economies. In the US, they've given reasonable indications that they're going to start, or they've said that they're going to start reducing it, probably the size of their balance sheet, before the end of the year, and do it very gradually, but they're going to start. So we'll see how that goes. I mean, it's had an influence on some markets. So, you know, equity prices are high in part because of the amount of stimulus which has been provided. But then, if you look at some other markets, it's not so obvious. So, the stimulus is out there to try and achieve outcomes in terms of output of employment, and that does have impacts on markets as well. At the same time, though, I spend, particularly my previous job as looking after the financial markets, I used to mostly hear complaints about how little liquidity there was in markets and how everything had deteriorated over the last few years. So, as I said, there's There's liquidity if you look at it in the aggregate, but when you get down to some of the micro levels, not quite so obvious.
I have a question over here on the right-hand side. Sorry, in the front on the right-hand side.
Thanks, Guy. It's very interesting to hear and see...
Sorry, let me interrupt.
Ken Williams, Statewide Super. Yeah. Very interesting to hear there's been a lot of debate about the Reserve Bank minutes. I'm just interested in your view on the state of economic discourse in this country, particularly observing over the last 20 years, whether or not you think it's become more or less sophisticated.
Wow. I don't know. That's a really hard question to answer. Actually, that's a really hard question to answer. It partly depends where you think that, in terms of where the discourse is taking place. I mean, I still think, I'm not sure whether the implication is it's worse than it used to be. One thing I think is interesting, in particularly having spent some time living in other parts of the world, is that the economic literacy of the Australian population, or economic interest and literacy, I think, of the Australian population is far greater than it is in a lot of other parts of the world, in that, you know, some of the stuff which appears on the front page of our papers wouldn't appear anywhere near the front pages of equivalent papers elsewhere in the world. So people seem to care about the economy more here than they do elsewhere. I don't know whether it's better or worse. One thing which is the case, which is not necessarily good for the future of economic discourse in the country, is that the amount of people studying economics, particularly in high school, has declined quite a lot over the past 10, 15, 20 years. And now people enrolling in directly in economics degrees is not necessarily as much as it used to. They'll do it as part of something else. But so that's declined. I'm not sure whether that's great for the future, so good for the future of economic discourse in the country. And that's one thing, at the Reserve Bank at least, we're mindful of and have actually started to try and do something to address by working with the various school boards around the country to try and provide material directly to high school economics, work with them on the curriculum, particularly in terms of macro and monetary policy and the like, stuff we know about, to try and make sure that the economic discourse in the future doesn't deteriorate and that people are appropriate, you know, have got the ability to participate in a reasonable way in there.
But let me make a supplementary comment. One other trend, it seems to me, is that the policy debates also got more noisy. So there's more voices, there's more organised voices, including around economic policy. So there's actually more opinion, but coming from groups which are organised around specific issues.
Yeah.
And that's very much, there's a little bit of our political science colleagues are thinking about this now. There's a notion of the vetocracy, that it's difficult to get things done because there's coalitions of interest groups around particular topics, which when anything comes up will complicate in a way the debate around.
Yeah, so that's not a problem unique to economics.
No.
That's a problem the policy more general,
yeah.
Generally, I
yeah.
think.
And I take the point on high school education in economics out of my responsibility. So I have a question at the back.
Guy, Michael Heath from Bloomberg News. I'm just interested in in the RBA's confidence in its forecasts. Seemed very upbeat in the minutes, and I know you mentioned that the strong labour market suggested that some of the downside risk for wages had lessened. I put it in the context, I guess, that John Edwards wrote a very interesting paper who similarly came to a neutral cash rate of 3.5% like you guys did, and he was foreseeing if you were achieving that, your forecasts, that you'd have to raise rates perhaps four times next year and four times the year after. I mean, is there a strong degree of confidence in the forecast, or is there a growing degree of confidence?
I'm not going to talk about future rate decisions,
sure.
Michael. And, glad you're also able to come back to Adelaide for this one as well.
Keep coming, guys.
Yeah. the comment about was more that we'd had this forecast for the labour market for a while, and just the more recent data seemed to more validate the central forecast. That wasn't saying anything more or less than that. The only other thing I would note is our forecasts are actually predicated on the expected path for policy rates, which at least at the time we put them out back in May was flat. So that's the forecasts are predicated on that. But it was just more that we'd seen stuff which seemed to give us a little bit more confidence that, so you're right, yes. Do we have a little bit more confidence? Yes, we have a little more confidence that the forecasts that we had were actually likely to come to pass. Not that they were necessarily going to be anything stronger than that, but just the forecasts that we actually had were stuff seemed to be coming along, which was in line with that, which is good and better than the alternative. So sort of nothing really more or less than that.
Who's next? Another question or comment? So let me ask you, while people are considering their options, one factor you pointed to was low investment. I should have checked the research first, but the sort of anecdote is that the capital intensity of the economy with new technology looks like it might be diminished. Is that a possibility?
It's a possibility, but you actually still need to spend money on stuff which embodies that technology to actually use it. So it's not obvious. I mean, the problem we have in Australia is that we just stick out like a complete exception from the rest of the world, because we've just come off the largest amount of investment spending pretty much, well, certainly in the last century. Mm. So everyone else in the world is talking about the low level of capital in the economy just after we've stuck in the largest amount of capital we've pretty much done in a long time. So it's a little bit different here than elsewhere, but it's not obvious. I mean, we've seen there has certainly been a shift to the services sector, and normally people have in their mind that services equals, you know, when you're doing services, the service part of the economy has less capital than, you know, than a factory. But then if you think about the health side of the part of the services sector, that can often, as you know, the evidence with the building down the end of North Terrace, that has a fair amount of capital in it, has some people in it too, but also has a fair amount of capital in it. So it's not necessarily the fact that as you move towards has got a lot of technology in it, but not necessarily as you shift towards the services sector that implies that the economy is going to become less capital intensive. So, I mean, it's one of the things that people have looked at, but it doesn't seem to be part of the explanation. As I said, there's no really cogent explanation as to why investment has been so low, beyond the fact that it's been a global rather than a local phenomenon. But it does seem to have something to do with the fact that there has been a bit of a dearth of animal spirits for a while, which may be changing. The only other thing is that the longer we've gone without that pickup in investment, it means that the existing capital stock is more depreciated, which at some point means you need to have a bit more investment rather than less.
Mm. I think the services story is a really interesting one, and our own South Australian Centre for Economic Studies recently put out their mid-year briefing, and one of the striking points in there is the growth of services exports from South Australia. So that's a national story too, I think.
Yeah, I mean, listening to Mike Brooks earlier, the education exports have been one of the fastest growing exports in the country for quite some time. So, I mean, service exports as a whole have actually been doing pretty well for quite a number of years now. It's very much an export story, not just a sort of domestic story.
So, wearing my exporter hat, I'd like you to do something about that exchange rate. You wouldn't mind. Yeah. Another comment or question? Here's a terrific opportunity to talk to someone who's on the board of the central bank and was involved in that meeting. where those minutes were reflected. I have a question at the back.
Daniel Rossi from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. In your presentation, you touched on wages growth and that, you know, misalignment between maybe recent labour market and economic outcomes and the slow rate of growth. I was wondering if you could share some of your thoughts on what's driving that misalignment at the moment.
Sure, and having given the University of Adelaide a plug, I'll give the ABS a plug, because actually we have had one of our staff spend some time at the ABS over the last little while, and to look at the unit record data, which means when the ABS goes out and surveys people on the wages front, they sort of, you know, do it person by person, so we get longitudinal data. So one of the things we did, or this member of our staff did when he was working at the ABS, was he looked at the unit record data, which underpinned behind something called the wage price index, which was actually the graph I had up there earlier. And what it shows is that one of the reasons why wage growth has declined here is not that it is that we've gone from a world where we had a lot of people getting 3 or 4% and some people getting 2% to now everyone, roughly, or a lot of people getting 2%. So it's not that everyone's experiencing lower wage growth, it's just the sort of normal wage outcome in the country has gone from being 3 or 4 down to 2. And so we have a much larger chunk of the workforce getting 2% now than what used to. It doesn't look like there's been a step below that, but we've just stopped having a chunk of the economy getting, or people, workers in the economy getting more than 2 are now getting 2. And that's why wage growth, that's at least arithmetically, why wage growth seems to have stepped down here. And also one reason why in our forecast we don't think it's necessarily going to go much lower, because through our liaison program, which at least in this part of the world Matt Carter runs, when they go out and talk to businesses, they're not talking about wage growth or wage outcomes slower than 2, which gives us some confidence in our forecast, which has things sort of stabilising here. But it does seem to have been just a sort of wage norm in the economy, if you want to put it that way, has shifted from being a number which might have been 3 or 4 to a number more like 2. As I said, how long that's going to last, we're not sure. Amongst other things, to the extent it's become more of the norm, it's a little harder to budge. But if the labour market continues to improve and the unemployment rate continues to decline, you would expect that we'd start to see that turn around. The only caveat on that is that if you take the US as a good example, the US unemployment rate is now below what most people, including the Fed, thinks is the rate at which you would have started to see wage and inflationary pressures build. But they have a little bit on the wage front, but they haven't on the inflation front. And so they've been sitting there with a low unemployment rate for quite a while now, and they haven't seen those wage and inflation pressures pick up. Same is true in the UK, same is true in Germany. The German unemployment rate's the lowest it's been in 40 years, and they're still not seeing really much in terms of wage or price pressure. So again, it's a global story. There seems to be, some of the research we've done at the bank seems to suggest there's some global common factor. What that global common factor is, we don't know. But there does seem to be a sort of a global element to it. And as I said when I was talking earlier, it remains, you know, the economics profession in central banks and elsewhere are spending a fair bit of time trying to get to the bottom of it, but to date, not particularly successful, which is a puzzle and somewhat concerning. But it's really something we're spending a lot of time trying to understand, but ultimately actually don't have a particularly good explanation for it.
Hi, Cathy Grant, RAA. Just when you're talking about the level of low levels of unemployment, how does that then balance out with the level of underemployment? Which is, we hear about that low level, but it's not translating to full-time employment for the younger demographics, and people are feeling worse off because we've got massive increases in energy prices, health prices, even education. So there are a lot of, you know, we talk about that unemployment, but it's really not the full story though, is it?
No, that's right. So we spend a fair bit of time looking, as you say, at underemployment, which actually has also come down over the last few months, because we've had 3 or 4 months now, including on the numbers which came out from the ABS on Thursday, we've had 3 or 4 months in a row of recorded strong growth in full-time employment. and some drop-off in part-time employment. So that underemployment rate that you're talking about actually has come down over the last 3 or 4 months from a fairly high level. Most of the time, the underemployment rate and the unemployment rate tend to move in pretty much in lockstep. But the gap between the two hasn't widened all that much up until about a year or two ago where it did widen a bit. So we've had these levels of underemployment above unemployment for a long time, and the gap hasn't moved all that much, but it did widen a bit a year or two ago, but it has narrowed a bit over the last few months. So certainly it's something that we pay a fair amount of attention to, and it's got something to do what I was just talking about a second ago as to why you don't see those sort of wage pressures emerging because of that underemployment which is out there. That's certainly one of the most obvious explanations that are around for that. And as you say, some of the rises in gas and electricity prices that you're seeing, including right now, also working on a not great for the household budget. And that's, again, something we certainly take into account in our outlook in terms, including thinking about what that's going to mean for household spending going forward. Both the two things you said, actually, both the degree of underemployment and low level of wages growth, but also then the effect of things like rising utility prices are something which very much we take into account in trying to work out where household spending is going to go over the next while.
Ken Williams again. Can you continue on that theme and talk about the participation rate? And in the US, as I understand it, the participation rate is now a good 3 percentage points lower than it was 10 years ago.
Yep.
And I understand that notwithstanding that you've got 4% unemployment, the actual absolute number of people employed is now lower than it was. Is the participation rate, is it purely demographics, or is that some contingent source of labour supply that's depressing wage growth?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think actually in the US they've now got more people employed. So they've got, what you said were right, but I think they've actually got more people. But a lot of it is demographics, and that's true here too. So we've had, if you think, we've had these very large rises in the participation rate, so over the 70s and 80s and 90s, mostly because of female participation in the workforce going up. And there's a large demographic element associated with that and with the sort of baby boom demographic, which is now moving out of the normal, or traditional, let me put it that way, working age into retirement. And so in the US, demographics, I can't remember the exact numbers, but do account for a reasonably large chunk of that decline in the participation rate. And it's also true here. But there's both, to your point, there's been a decently large cyclical element as well as that sort of structural demographic element. In the US, though, the general assessment is that that cyclical element, has mostly passed, and mostly what you're looking at now is the sort of structural demographic element. Here it's probably still a bit of a combination of the two, but that said, we've seen the measured participation rate in Australia actually tick up quite a bit over the last few months. Not quite back to where it was a few years ago, but it's not so far below it now.
Thanks. Is there one more? Who else? Let me ask one while people are thinking about their options. So the bank obviously monitors carefully what's happening in Asia. I mean, I think there's a contradiction between the animal spirit story and the opportunities that I see when working with the university and visiting our research partners, talking to our partners about recruiting students. Now, the prospects for growth remain strong in our region and in the US. So where does this contradiction come from between that circumstance and the way that people seem to be thinking about the returns to investment?
I don't know. I mean, that's the question a lot of people have answered and haven't come up with a good answer. I think some chunk of it has got to do with the fallout from the crisis, that sort of left somewhat more permanent, long-lasting psychological scars. That, to some extent, if you want to use the sort of economics investment literature, you know, the reward, there was a reward for waiting to see whether things get better. And the financial crisis very much reinforced that. The option value of waiting went up a lot. And I don't think we've completely unwound that. Maybe we're getting to the point where that is starting to unwind. But, and as I said in my talk earlier, there's a decent amount of self-fulfillingness to this. But if you think things aren't going to be all that strong and you don't do stuff as a result, then lo and behold, they aren't all that strong. And the converse is also true. If you do think things are going to be strong and you do a lot more investment spending, then lo and behold, the economy does turn out to be strong. If you go back to your page one of your first sort of macroeconomics textbook, you know, the circular flow of income does actually matter, which is another way of putting it. So, as you said, the opportunity, I mean, I don't think the lack of there is an argument that Bob Gordon, for instance, puts out there, and Larry Summers, which, you know, the sort of secular stagnation argument or variant of that, which is there aren't opportunities out there. I don't think I don't share that pessimism. I think, as you're saying, there are the opportunities out there. People may be reluctant to take advantage of them, even though the financing costs or whatever and the corporate balance sheets are actually very strong. So I don't think I personally don't think it's the absence of opportunities, even though there are some who make that argument. I think it's as much just a long lingering effect of the financial crisis in terms of people's willingness to just wait a bit more rather than take that plunge.
One more to close.
Okay, we've got one. All right.
Just when you talk about, I guess, the level of confidence and the animal instinct and that, what's your view or position about where the role of government plays in driving that sense of drive? And I know they're meant to be facilitators, they're not the doers, but the way we have in our political environment doesn't leave a lot of confidence for business.
So being from the central bank, I am going to happily stay right away from that question. So, that can only go not well.
Good. Well, thanks very much, ladies and gentlemen. Don't applause yet. I'm going to invite Vince Pace, the CFO from the People's Credit Union, to come and give the vote of thanks.
Thank you, Christopher, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's an absolute pleasure to have the opportunity to provide a vote of thanks today to Professor Christopher Finlay and Dr. Guy DeBell. I'm sure I can speak for everyone here when I say how much we appreciate Guy returning to Adelaide to share some really candid insights into Australia's economy. At People's Choice, we know from talking with our members, and that's one in five South Australians, that it can be difficult to get an objective sense of how the economy is really faring and where the challenges and the opportunities lay. There's lots of commentators and there's certainly lots of agendas that need to be considered. So it is really refreshing, interesting and educational to have someone of Guy's standing and calibre here with us to cut through a lot of the noise and to give us a deeper insight into our current economic reality. In his position, Guy does have to walk a political tightrope, but I certainly have benefited today from his expertise, as I'm sure we've all in this room. To Professor Christopher Finlay, thank you very much for your role today in introducing Guy and facilitating what I found to be a very spirited discussion. I know that many locals in the room here today, as am I, very proud of the University of Adelaide, living in a city that can boast such a globally recognised and high-calibre university that continues its long-standing success in producing absolutely outstanding graduates. On behalf of CEDA and everyone here today, I'd like to genuinely thank both of you for your time and ask that you both step forward just to accept a small token of our appreciation. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd please join me in thanking Professor Christopher Finlay and Dr. Guy DeBell. Thank you.